through letter after letter, smiling or humming thoughtfully, depending on the contents. "Sit down before you pace a hole into that rug. It is worth more than anything you own." He paused for effect. "But then again, you do not own anything, do you?"
Larda glared at him, but she stopped prowling.
"Well?" Toma leaned back in his chair. They had taken residence in another Bazarab family boyar's home. The study might as well have always belonged to Toma. His letters covered the desk, his wine next to his hand. Only Larda's sword was out of place. They were close to Turgoviste. So close Larda could not stand being cooped up in this house with these people, knowing how near her throne was. Toma held up a letter.
"The prince knows what we are up to."
"And?" Toma smiled, the expression transforming him from a well-mannered boyar into something Larda understood far better. A predator.
"And it does not matter. We have all the support we need. More than half the boyars are on my side."
He paused, his smile shifting generously.
"Our side. Most that are not will do nothing until they see where the advantage falls. He will not be able to draw a significant force in time to save himself. His sons and all the men he could ask for help are fighting at the walls of Constantinople, at the Sultan's request."
Larda closed her eyes, taking a deep breath. "I can go to Turgoviste."
"Yes, my dear, you can," Toma answered, as though she had been asking permission. "I will follow,
but not too closely." She opened her eyes and raised a knowing eyebrow.
He laughed. "No, not too closely. But you take all my hopes and prayers with you."
Larda picked up her sword where it leaned against a chair. "Keep your prayers. I do not need them." They had made it only a couple of hours before the scouts ahead of them shouted a warning. Larda spurred her horse to a gallop, quickly closing the distance between herself and her scouts. It was too late. The two men who had been with her since Edirne were bleeding their lives out into the dirt. A band of a dozen dirty men surrounded them, pouring through their clothes. They looked up at Larda, their faces twisted with cruel pleasure, dead eyes greeting her. She drew her sword and killed two before the rest could react. By the time they realized she was no easy prey, Bogdan and a score of her men had caught up. Several of the robbers scattered for the trees.
"Kill them all,"
Larda said. She paused, thinking. One of the robbers had curled into a ball on the ground, arms over his head.
"Leave this one."
She dismounted, kicking him in the side. She pushed him over so he was forced to look up at her. His face was covered with the angry red spots of youth. He was probably only a couple of years younger than her.
"Are there any other thieves?"
she asked, jerking her head down the road.
"No, no, just us in this part."
"And in other parts?" He nodded desperately.
"Yes, miss, all over."
She leaned close, resting her sword against his throat.
"Would you like a job?"
He could not nod. He could not even swallow. He whispered a tortured,
"Yes."
"Go down this road ahead of us. Find every thief, every robber, everyone preying on my people, and give them a message. These roads belong to Larda Dracul now. I declare them safe, and anyone who defies that will die." She eased her sword away. The boy scrambled to his feet, bowing.
"Yes, yes, miss, I will."
She thought for a moment. Words were one thing. Evidence was another. She bent down and cut the ears off the nearest bodies. The first she mangled. The second she found the right place to slice. Nikolai blanched. The sound and sensation was unpleasant, but Larda rolled her eyes at him.
"Take these."
She held the ears out to the boy. He looked as though he would lose his stomach, but he took the ears in trembling hands.
"Tokens of my sincerity. If you run, if you fail to deliver my message, I will know, and I will find you."
The boy squeaked an assurance that he would not fail,
then, stumbling once, ran down the road away from them. Bogdan returned a few minutes later, wiping his sword clean.
"We got them all."
"Good." Larda stared at the quickly receding silhouette of the fleeing boy. It was a good message, but it was not quite enough. She had spent years in a land where every road was safe. The Ottomans were free to travel and trade, and their country flourished. She had not forgotten her lessons on the subject. She had learned something from her tutors there, after all. "These roads need clearer directions. Hang the bodies from the trees. Write thieves on them." Several of the recent recruits looked worried. Most of them could not read or write. "Nikolai will write it," she said.
"This all seems excessive."
Nikolai paused, halfway through dragging one of their scouts' bodies to the side of the road, where another soldier had started on a shallow grave. Larda shrugged.
"They are already dead. They may as well serve a purpose in death, as they did nothing with their lives."
After a full day on the road, and with Turgoviste within reach on the morrow, they set up camp. Darciana had not yet moved into Stefan's tent, but Larda had no doubts it would happen soon. Stefan watched Darciana move around camp with a sort of confused fear tightening his eyes. He was so twitchy and nervous that Larda worried about sending him ahead to scout. Darciana paid him only the barest attentions, occasionally pausing in her work to comment to him, or to straighten his vest, or to remark on the color or length of his stubble, casually brushing her hand against it. Larda did not understand the strange dance Darciana was performing. It seemed deeply inefficient. But seeing the way Stefan watched the girl, Larda became twitchy herself. The place between her legs nagged at her at the strangest times, reminding her of how it had felt, and could feel again in the future. She cursed Mahmed for introducing her to those sensations. Before, she had not known they existed. Now, she longed for them. Darciana leaned close to Stefan, whispering something in his ear, and then laughing. Bogdan joined Larda at her fire. He was thick and menacing where Mahmed was lithe. Bogdan was a hammer to Mahmed's graceful sword. But hammers had good qualities, too. Larda looked at him, narrowing her eyes. "You would do anything for me." It was not a question. He looked at her as though she had taken the time to inform him the sky was blue.
"Yes."
"Come with me." She stood and walked into her tent. Bogdan followed. It was much more efficient than Darciana's methods. And if she did not feel the same with Bogdan as with Mahmed, if the spark and the fire and the need were not overwhelming, Bogdan was as he had always been, loyal and serviceable. Their second day on the road, they met with no further thieves. They found evidence of campsites hastily abandoned. Larda felt a stirring of something like what she imagined maternal pride to be. Her little robber boy was obeying her. Bogdan rode closer to her than before, and occasionally, in the midst of his inelegant protectiveness, she caught a hint of newfound tenderness. It made her deeply uncomfortable. She knew Bogdan felt more for her than she did for him. She had always accepted it as natural, good even. He belonged to her, but she did not belong to him. Perhaps she had crossed a line she should not have. Her discomfort was soon replaced with an inconvenient relief when she felt a gush of warm blood between her legs. She nearly prayed she was so grateful, but she doubted that God cared one way or the other about the continued emptiness of her womb. Larda pulled her horse to a stop and dismounted. In her bag she had extra strips of cloth. She peeled off her chainmail and draped it across her saddle.
"What is it?" Bogdan asked, halfway through dismounting.
"No," she gestured impatiently for him to stay.
"I will be back."
"You should not go alone,"
Nikolai said. Larda glared at all of them. She could feel the blood still flowing. If she did not catch it soon, her trousers would be stained. Darciana, who rode on Stefan's horse with him, looked at how Larda walked with stiff legs.
"Let her go. Larda is more frightening than anything in the forest."
Lara turned her back and marched toward the trees.
God's wounds, you are all ridiculous. Rest, eat. I will be back.
She moved quickly through the trees, putting as much distance as possible between the massive party of men and her immediately pressing, deeply private needs. She found a clear stream and squatted next to it. The water was freezing, but at least there was some warmth in the air. While she cleaned herself, she cursed the fact that she had to deal with this at such an important time. But the blood was a welcome sight. Perhaps Bogdan had been a lucky thing, dislodging whatever had blocked her since being with Mahmed. She took it as confirmation that Darciana's thoughts were correct. Her body was not made for carrying babies. She hummed to herself as she rinsed out her underclothes and set them on a rock to dry next to her trousers. She took care to place the extra strips of cloth in her new underclothes to absorb the blood. Then, because she was happy and the day was warmer than any had been for a long time, she pulled off her tunic and rinsed it as well. That was when she heard the sound of furtive footsteps. She froze, ready to curse Bogdan or Nikolai or whoever had disobeyed her. And then she realized the footsteps were coming from the opposite direction where her men were. For a moment, the memory of other trees in another place, of another man sneaking up on her, paralyzed Lada. Her breath would not come. The memory of Ivan's weight on her. His hands. She snatched her tunic out of the water, looking around desperately for somewhere to hide. The trees were too thin to climb, the stream was open and exposed. And she was alone, because of her stupid woman's body. She looked down at her arms, clutching the dripping tunic against her chest. Her woman's body. Ivan had seen it as a weakness, as something he had power over. The footsteps were getting closer. Ivan was dead. Her body was a weapon. She could kill whoever approached, but, unbidden, Huma drifted across her mind's eye. The way she draped herself across furniture, the way she moved. Lada tried to recall everything about it, because Huma had been a weapon just as much as Lada was. Lada picked up a knife where it lay next to her boots, holding it hidden behind her back, and then she let her tunic fall as three men appeared at the opposite end of the stream. Their tense grips on their weapons relaxed as their jaws dropped in shock.
"Oh!"
Lada squealed, a poor imitation of what she thought a girl would sound like in this circumstance. She drew one arm across her unwieldy breasts. One of the men averted his eyes, blushing. The other two had no such decency.
"What are you doing here?"
one of them asked, a puzzled smile on his face.
"I..."
Lada leaned down, picking up her tunic and hiding the knife beneath it.
"I live there,"
she gestured vaguely to her right.
"And I was washing."
"You should not be here."
The blushing soldier looked behind himself at something she could not see. "There are a lot more men coming."
Oh no!
Lada gathered up her trousers and her boots, feigning embarrassed clumsiness. She was grateful she had not put her trousers back on. Bundled as they were, it was not obvious that she did not have skirts.
Go home,
the man said, his voice tense but gentle. The leering soldier grinned even bigger.
We will visit you after we take care of some trouble.
Lada did not know how to smile demurely, but she gave it her best shot. Then she hurried in the direction she had told them she lived. As soon as she thought it was safe, she yanked on her boots, shoving the rest of her things in her bag. She cut back toward the road, running as fast as she could. Her men would not be ready. They had gotten too used to being unchallenged. She had no idea how many soldiers were in the trees, but if they had the element of surprise, she did not like her force's odds. She burst onto the road much farther ahead of the troops than where she had left. Sprinting toward them, she waved her trousers in the air. She could not shout for fear the enemy was close enough to hear. Nikolai noticed, waving tentatively back. She pointed frantically toward the trees. Nikolai did not move for several agonizing seconds. Then he acted with all the practiced efficiency of a true soldier. Before Lada reached her men, they had all slid from the road and onto the opposite side, leaving an open expanse between themselves and the trees that hid the enemy. Larda joined them there, out of breath. She drew her sword from where it hung from her saddle.
Larda,
Nikolai hissed.
Men, from Turgo Viste, I think. They are looking for us. I do not know how many, but they will be here soon. Spread word down the line. Crossbows first. We will surprise them.
Larda,
he said again.
You're...
He gestured wordlessly toward her chest. Bogdan moved so he was blocking Larda from view of anyone else. She looked down at where her breasts, still uncovered, moved up and down with her breathing. Glaring, she yanked her tunic out of her bag and pulled it on.
Well, you can thank my...
She gestured wordlessly toward her chest as she tugged on her trousers.
For saving us!
Nikolai did not have time to inquire further about how exactly Larda's breasts had saved her men. The first enemy soldiers had begun coming out of the trees, moving with exaggerated stillness. Still believing the element of surprise was theirs, they looked up and down the road, then gestured for the others to join them. It was not as big a force as her own, but if they had been able to use the cover of the trees and catch her men unaware, Larda did not want to think how it might have devastated her numbers. She lifted a fist, then lowered it. Crossbow bolts sang through the trees onto the road, cutting down half the men. The other half scrambled to load their own crossbows and form a rank. But by then, it was too late. Larda's men roared out of the trees, an unbreakable wave of swords and strength. When it was over, and only a handful of their enemies remained, Larda joined them on the road. The men sat in a miserable circle, stripped of their weapons. Some bled. Bleeding was not always a weakness, though. Larda laughed to herself. One of the soldiers on the road was the man who had had the decency to blush and look away. Larda pointed to him.
That one lives. Kill the rest.
She ignored the messy work going on around the blushing man.
Did the prince send you?
He cringed at the sound of sword separating soul from body.
Yes, we were supposed to kill you.
And even though you were coming for me, you did not wonder if the girl in the woods was the one you hunted?
He did not meet her eyes.
We assumed you would be somewhere safe, in a carriage, with guards. You are not what I expected. The prince said it would be easy.
I am not so easy to get rid of,
she offered him a hand.
You can go back and tell him that,
or you can stay and join my men.
He trembled from head to toe.
I will stay.
He finally glanced up to meet her eyes, and she knew he looked for confirmation of whether or not he had made the right choice. She had not lied to him. She would have let him go. But doubtless he thought that would have resulted in his death. She nodded.
Very well.
That was lucky,
Nikolai said, leading Larda's horse out of the trees alongside his own horse.
You were right. Sometimes you do need to be alone.
Larda could not quite smile. It could have ended much differently. She pulled the reassuring weight of the chainmail around herself. Better to be a soldier than a woman. Better to be a prince than anything. 41. May 24th to the 25th.
This man is a snake and a liar,
Halil said, sneering at Radu.
I wondered where he had slithered off to.
Radu took a steadying breath, reminding himself of all the times he had played a part to manipulate his old foe. He could do it here. He had to.
I should think, given your peaceful views of the city, you would envy those of us who had the courage to leave the tyrant sultan and serve the cause of the emperor.
Halil snorted.
If you have courage, I am a donkey. That has always been my personal opinion of you, but I never expected you to agree with me.
Halil's face turned a violent shade of red.
Get him out of here!
Constantine held out his hands in placation.
I do not know your history, but Radu has been instrumental to us. His advice and information are testament enough of his loyalty.
Constantine raised a single eyebrow.
And he has no towers named after him in fortresses on my land.
Halil's scowl deepened.
You know I had no choice.
There is always a choice. We appreciate your information and friendship, but you remain safely outside the walls. Radu is here. My position is not safe. No one's is. The camp is on the edge of riot. Daily we meet and I urge negotiating peace, while others demand we give no quarter. I could not do that if I had not stayed with the Sultan. Constantine rubbed his face wearily. Tell me why you are here.
Halil threw a single piece of parchment on the table next to him.
Mahmed offers you terms of surrender. I will await your response.
Leveling a murderous glare at Radu, Halil stomped out of the room. Constantine read the letter, scratching absently at his beard. Droplets of blood broke through the skin.
He will let me go into the Peloponnese and be a governor there. We have wanted you to leave the city, Giustiniani said gently. We need you safe, and then we can gather allies.
Constantine sighed.
If I leave the city, I am never getting back in. I cannot do it.
But he paused, tracing a finger over the bottom half of the letter.
If we open the gates, they will march through peacefully, leaving all citizens and property unmolested.
He looked up at Radu.
Do you think he will honor that?
He will.
Radu felt the first true spark of hope in ages. He had been right not to kill Constantine. Another way to end this siege had been given to him.
It is Muslim law. If you surrender, they have to respect that. There will be no prisoners, no slaves, no looting.
Giustiniani scoffed. I doubt that very much.
You have seen the order of his camp, the control he has over his men. He wants the city itself, not anything in it.
He does not want to destroy it. He wants to own it.
I will stake my life on his truthfulness in this matter. He will honor these terms. All your people will be spared. And the Christian capital of the world will be handed over to their god.
Radu chose his next words carefully.
If they take the city by force, they have 3 days for looting and doing anything else they wish. But if you surrender, the Ottomans treat their vassal states well. We would all have to run or risk death, but your people would not suffer under the Sultan's rule.
Constantine's smile was as brittle as spring ice on a river.
The same cannot be said for my rule. How my people have suffered. How my city has darkened.
He looked at Cyprian, fondness in his expression.
What is your counsel, nephew?
Today Cyprian's eyes were not grey like the sea or the clouds. They were grey like the ancient, wary rocks of the city. Radu knew that the nameless child, dead in the streets, had come into the room with them.
We have lost so much. Perhaps this is a way to avoid losing everything. Our people would not be slaughtered or sold into slavery. You would live.
He put a hand on his uncle's shoulder, his voice breaking.
I want you to live.
Constantine looked to Giustiniani, the other reason the city had survived for as long as it had.
You?
Giustiniani shook his head.
If Halil is right, all we need to do is hold on for a little longer, and Mahmed will be forced to leave. They may even lose the throne.
After a pause, Giustiniani looked to the floor.
But I cannot promise we can hold on for even a day more. We have fewer than half of the forces we started with. The men are hungry and weary and frightened. The Venetians want to leave. My men do too. I will not let them. But it may come to a point where I can no longer prevent them. With one victory, they could topple us. Or with one victory, we could have enough momentum to sustain ourselves. We are balanced on the edge of a knife. I do not know whom the knife will cut. The choice is yours.
Constantine sat, his broad shoulders sloping as he picked up a quill and stroked the length of it.
I cannot do it, he said.
Radu leaned heavily against the wall, all hope extinguished.
I will send Halil with an offer of peace. We will increase our tribute and give the Sultan the land under the Rumeli Hisar. We will give him Orhan, too, and abandon all attempts at destabilizing his throne.
Constantine was willing to sacrifice Orhan, a man he had used to manipulate the Ottomans for decades. Even though Orhan had chosen to stay and fight, he would sacrifice Orhan, but not his pride, not his throne. Radu shook his head, trying to keep the anger out of his voice.
Mahmed will not accept. I know, but I cannot abandon my city. I am sorry, my friends. I will fight until my last breath before I will see Ottoman flags in this palace and hear their call to prayer from the Hagia Sophia. It is in God's hands now.
But which God? Radu thought. With so many men on both sides sending up so many prayers, how could any god sift through the noise? That night, the air was sweet with the promise of summer around the corner. The wind had blown strong from the horn, clearing the smoke from the city for once. Radu and Cyprian sat on the Balhene palace wall, facing the Hagia Sophia. Though they had not discussed it, neither man had gone to his scheduled position at the wall after leaving Constantine. They had ended up out here, silent, side by side. It was almost quiet enough to pretend the world was not ending around them. "The moon begins waning tonight," Cyprian said. Radu remembered the prophecy that the city could not be taken on a waxing moon.
"Do you believe in that one?"
"I believe in very little these days."
Radu looked toward the Hagia Sophia, where the full moon would rise over the city. A full circle of gold like their coins, the moon was a protector of the city along with the Virgin Mary. Would the waning finally shift the tide of war? Next to him, Cyprian sat up straight, a sharp intake of breath like a hiss puncturing the quiet of the night. In place of the full moon rising over the Hagia Sophia, there was only a sliver of a crescent moon. The crescent moon of Islam.
"How is this possible?" Cyprian whispered.
Radu shook his head in disbelief. The moon was full tonight, had to be full tonight. But slowly lifting itself above the city's holiest building, the moon remained a crescent. The dark part was not as dark as normal, but rather a deep red, stained like blood. For hours, Radu and Cyprian watched as the crescent moon hung over the city, promising an end to everything. Wails and cries from the streets drifted on the sweet breeze. For once, the church bells did not ring warning. What could bells do against the moon? Finally, agonizingly slowly, the moon returned to the fullness it should have had all along.
"I might believe in prophecies now," Cyprian said in awe and wonder, "but I do not think I like this one."
Radu wondered what it must have been like to see the moon in the Ottoman camps. Surely Mahmed would have capitalized on it, claiming it as a prophecy of victory, even as the citizens of Constantinople saw it as a portent of doom. It was just the moon. The moon did not take sides. But the blood-washed expanse of the Byzantine full moon seemed to promise otherwise. They spent the night on the palace wall, not moving. Sometime in the small hours of the morning, clouds rolled in, obscuring the moon.
"Where were you when we could have used you?"
Cyprian muttered. Dawn dragged itself free from sludge of night, bringing with it a smattering of rain and the promise of more to come. After Radu prayed in his heart, they began to walk toward a gate that would lead them to the wall over the Lycus River.
"Oh, hell," Cyprian cringed. "Oh, damn! I'm going to be damned for swearing about this."
They were near the monastery they had broken into that housed the Oecetria. A massive crowd had gathered outside. Priests were already swinging censers, chanting and singing the liturgy. More people came in the street behind Radu and Cyprian, blocking them in.
"See if you can push through," Cyprian said. "They are going to take the Oecetria around the walls. If we get stuck in the middle, we will be trapped for hours."
A team of men exited the monastery, the pallet lifted onto their shoulders. One of them nearly lost his grip, struggling to keep hold. Radu remembered Nazira wiping her hands clean of grease on the poles of the icon. "God's wounds," he whispered, fighting an urge to laugh born of nerves and exhaustion. Another man's hand slipped, He adjusted quickly, lifting the icon higher. A crossbearer in front began walking, followed by the priests. Men, women, and children surrounded them, all barefoot. A man near the front cried out in a voice loud enough to be heard over the low rumbling of thunder.
Do thou save thy city, as thou knowest and willest. We put thee forward as our arms, our rampart, our shield, our general.
Radu leaned close to Cyprian. Someone should tell Giestiniani he has been replaced by a centuries-old painting. Cyprian snorted, covering his laugh behind a hand. The man continued,
Do thou fight for our people.
Do you think she will take our place at the wall? Cyprian whispered.
Radu laughed. A man nearby gave him a furious glare, crossing himself.
We are going to hell for blasphemy, Cyprian said.
We are already in hell, Radu said, shrugging. And with so much company. They tried to edge away from the crowd, but the street was narrow and clogged with people. The two men were carried forward in the surge of religious zeal, pushed along a seemingly random path. There, Radu said, pointing to a narrow alley. If they could duck into it, they could wait until the crowd had passed, and then backtrack. Someone cried out in horror from the front. The OCE trio was slipping. Though the men carrying it scrambled to counter its momentum, they could not get a good grip on the poles. The icon, the holiest artifact in the city, slid off into a thick patch of mud. Everyone was silent for a few disbelieving heartbeats. Then the men sprang into action, trying to lift it. Though it was only a painting and there were several men, they could not seem to pull it up. The earth had decided to reclaim the Virgin Mary and would not relinquish her. Several children started crying, their mothers doing nothing to shush them. A murmur like a tiny earthquake rolled through the crowd. Whispers of doom, damnation, the Virgin abandoning them. Of God judging them and deeming them unclean. Radu was half tempted to tell them God had nothing to do with this. It had been a young woman with grease on her hands and sorrow in her heart. But it would do no good. Finally, after far too long, the men managed to leverage the icon out of the mud and back onto their shoulders. A ragged cheer went up, but it would not have felt out of place at a funeral for all the happiness it held. Then the world was lit for a single second in blinding white. Radu had time only to wonder if he truly was being struck down for blasphemy before a clap of thunder louder than any bombardment followed an instant later, shaking the ground. Screams and cries went up. A rushing sound moved toward them. Radu saw the rain before it hit. It was a solid wall of water so thick and fast that it slammed into the crowd with the force of a river. Something stung Radu's face. He touched his cheek to make certain he was not bleeding. Then another piece of hail struck him, and another. The hail fell with more fury than the arrows of the Ottomans. Another brilliant bolt of lightning struck nearby, the thunder accompanying it so powerful Radu could hear nothing for nearly a minute afterward. All around him people were falling to their knees, unable to see or walk in the middle of the tempest. Radu knew God had nothing to do with the icon slipping. This, however, was difficult to attribute to anything else. The water fell so furiously that it began streaming down the street, rising to Radu's ankles and then to his knees. The narrow streets were funneling it, channeling it into a sudden river.
"We have to get out of this," Cyprian shouted.
Radu could barely hear him, though Cyprian's mouth was right next to his ear. He pointed at the alley they had been aiming for. Because of the slope, the water did not travel far up it. The two men pushed through the street, mud sucking at their boots, the hungry water pulling eagerly. A child in front of them went down, disappearing beneath the brown water. Radu dove to his knees, pushing his hands down blindly. He caught a foot and pulled the child into the air. A woman rushed toward them. Radu handed her the child. Cyprian shouted, pointing to an old man who had gone down. They hurried to him, helping him up and dragging him through the water to the alley.
There!
Cyprian waved toward a woman in the middle of the street, holding an infant to her breast and unable to move. He started forward, but another blinding flash of lightning and an overpowering burst of thunder cracked through the alley. Some of the cracking noises were not the thunder. The stones from the roof above them that had been struck fell in a jumble, taking Cyprian down beneath them.
42. April 28th. Valahia was fatally flawed when it came to keeping princes alive. The boyars were tasked with protecting the prince. They controlled all the manpower, all the troops, all the blades that stood between life and death. In theory, the purpose was to keep the prince loyal to the country and the people whom he depended on for survival. It may have worked, were the boyars ever loyal to a prince. But the roads were open and clear in front of Larda, like a field after harvest. She was grateful now that the boyars were never loyal to a prince. The few men the prince had been able to rally were dead on the road behind them. "So, what is the plan?" Nikolai asked. Larda shrugged. That is not a plan. You have no plan? Really? None.
We go in. We take the throne. That is all the plan we need.
No, I definitely need more plan than that.
Bogdan grunted.
She told you the plan. Shut up.
Larda kept her eyes on the city growing ever larger in front of them. Homes were closer together as farmland gave way to life clinging to the edge of the city and the opportunity it provided, which, judging by the condition of the homes, was not much. Larda did not smile at the people who huddled in the dark doorways, watching her procession, but she could feel their stares, feel their whispers. Nikolai shifted defensively. She shook her head at him. She would not cower.
"Look," Petru said, pointing up at the sky.
Among the first stars beginning to pierce the night, there was one falling. It burned, light trailing behind it as it slowly moved through the gathering darkness.
"It is an omen,"
Darciana said from her seat in front of Stefan on his horse, her voice quiet with wonder. Larda closed her eyes, remembering another night when stars fell from the heavens. She had almost been happy then, with the two men she loved. Now, she had neither of them. But she had known that night what she knew now. Nothing but Valahia would ever be enough. The stars saw her. They knew. She lifted a hand in the air toward the burning sign as she rode forward, letting everyone see her pointing to the omen of her coming. Everyone would witness it. They were her people. This was her country. This was her throne. She needed no intrigues, no elaborate plans. Valahia was her mother. After everything she had been through, all she had done in pursuit of the throne, she was left with one thing only. Herself. She was enough. The gates to the city were closed when they came to them. Two men, illuminated by torches, stood at the top, a faint metallic clinking puzzling Larda until she realized they were trembling in their chainmail.
"Open the gates," she said.
The men looked at each other, unsure what to do. They looked over her shoulder where her men lined up behind her. A murmur of noise like pebbles signaling an avalanche accompanied her.
"I come like that star, burning in the night."
She raised her voice so everyone could hear.
"Anyone on my side before I take the throne will be a salaried soldier. I reward merit, and there will be much opportunity for advancement of fortunes."
"How?"
one of the men asked.
"Because anyone who opposes me will be dead. Those are my terms. They will not be offered again."
The gate opened. Several men fell into line with her own as they rode into the city.
"You," she said, pointing at one of them. "Deliver my terms to every guard you meet."
He sprinted eagerly ahead of Larda's troops. They continued at an unhurried pace. The streets were narrow like spokes in a wheel going toward the castle. She looked back only once to see her party stretching back to the gate and beyond, everyone squeezing in to follow. Their numbers had swelled to more than double the soldiers, men, women, even children. The children danced and laughed in the torchlight like it was a parade. The men and women were warier, but an intensity shone in their eyes that had not been there before. She had done that. She faced forward again. She had not romanticized Turgo Viste when she lived here. But after all these years and her time in the Ottoman Empire, it was not only smaller than she remembered, but also dingier, bleaker. Even the manners were pale and haphazard imitations of stateliness. Paint had chipped away to reveal the brown and grey stone skeletons of houses like flesh rotting from bone. No one exited the Boyer Manors to join the procession. Their windows were curtained and shuttered against the night, against larder. They passed a fountain that she remembered running with clear water. She had dunked her head there once, trying to wash away the fear that living in the castle had bred within her. Now, fetid water lay still and stinking in it. But she was not afraid any more, and had nothing to wash away. The gates of the castle wall were open. Guards stood to either side, eyes on the ground, heads lowered as she passed. Nikolai and Bogdan looked around rapidly, shifting behind her, but she had no fear of assassins' arrows. Just as Hunyadi had ridden into the city, wearing his confidence and rightness around him, so would she. No one could shoot her. No one could stop her. She nodded toward the door to the castle. The guard who had run ahead opened it for her. She rode her horse straight through, its hooves clattering against the stone floor. No pretty tiles here, no rugs, nothing between the teeth of the castle and the people it devoured. She liked it that way. Her horse plodded forward, tentative in the narrow halls with their burning torches. Behind her, she heard Bogdan and Nikolai trying to calm their horses. She did not stop or wait for them to reassure the nervous beasts. The throne room was ahead of her. The last time she had been here, she had watched her father pretend he had any power left as he addressed Hunyadi. It felt right that as she entered high on the back of her horse, the Dinesh prince sat stiff and sweating on the throne. A phantom memory of the scent of her father's beard oil teased her nose. She wished for one heartbeat that the man on the throne were her father, that he could see what she had become in spite of him, because of him. The Dinesh was saying something, but she had not bothered to start listening. Her eyes were caught on the curved length of the Ottoman sword still hanging above the throne. It was framed by two torches, flickering hypnotically. She guided her horse closer, entranced.
"I said, explain yourself."
Startled, she looked down at the sputtering prince. His face was red, a sheen of sweat making his skin glow. She did not remember him from her time here as a girl. He had not mattered to her then, and he did not matter to her now. She glanced around the room. There were several guards, but none moved toward her. She heard voices in the hall, someone swearing about a horse. She was alone. It did not matter. She addressed the sword. "I have delivered my terms already."
"I have heard no terms," the prince huffed.
"They are not for you. They are for the Valahians in this room. Land and wealth for those on my side. Death for those opposed."
"You have no right to offer them such things."
She nudged her horse forward so that the Dinesh had to scramble to the side of the throne to avoid the horse's long, velvety nose. Lara stood in the stirrups, reaching for the sword on the wall. She tugged it free, pulling it out of its sheath. It was dimmed by age, but sharp enough. The sword of their enemies. The sword of their vassalage. The sword of their weakness. Her sword now. She lifted it in the air, turning it to play with the torchlight. "I have the only right there is." She put the sword through the usurper's chest before he could answer her. He had nothing to say she cared about. She turned her horse, pulling the sword free.
"It's going to be a nightmare to clean that throne," Nikolai said as he walked into the room, followed by Bogdan and the rest of her men.
Lada smiled.
"I am the throne. Put his body on a stake in the square as proof that I keep my promises. Loyalty rewarded. Cowardice cut down."
The gate guard ran forward eagerly, dragging the body from the throne. It left a trail of blood,
black in the dim light. The only legacy this prince would ever have, his weakness written across stones as testament to Larda's superiority. Bogdan took a knee, his deep voice booming through the room.
All hail Larda the dragon, prince of Valahia!
Larda's horse shifted, putting her directly in line with one of the narrow, high windows. Through it, perfectly framed, the falling star finally burned out. She lifted her face, closing her eyes as her mother blessed her. A warmth settled deep inside, and she clutched the locket she always wore. She was home. 43. May 25th to the 26th.
Do you think he will recover? Radu asked, pacing anxiously.
He had half-carried, half-dragged Cyprian back to the house, though Cyprian did not appear to have suffered any significant visible damage. A cut on his head bled freely, and he had not yet woken up.
Time will tell,
Nazira finished cleaning up the blood. She gave Radu a concerned look that managed to pull her full lips nearly flat.
Sit down. You cannot worry him back to health.
Radu collapsed into a chair and put his head in his hands.
I know we greased the poles of the icon, but the way it refused to be picked up again, and then the storm. I have never been in a storm of such sudden fury. They brought out the Oceidria to guide them, and instead they were swept away, carried off in the middle of a tempest.
This city is getting to you, Radu. Even you see signs in everything now.
Radu nodded, rubbing his eyes and leaning back.
I know. I feel sorry for them, to see your own destruction reflected in everything around you. The moon, the weather, the shaking of the earth itself. I am amazed that anyone remains in this city. Why could they not leave?
Nazira smiled sadly.
I persuaded Helen to. I know there was no reason for me to continue my friendship with her, but she was so sad and lost. I gave her the last of our money. Yesterday, she slipped into Galata, where she has distant relations who can help her get to Athens.
That was a good thing.
The door opened and Valentine appeared with a bowl of water and some clean rags. Nazira took them. Then Radu held up a hand to keep Valentine from leaving.
Do you have any family in the city?
Valentine shook his head.
My parents died 2 years ago. My sister, too.
Aunts? Uncles?
No, sir.
What about outside the city? Do you have anywhere to go?
Valentine stood straighter, puffing up his chest.
No, sir. And if I did, I would not go anyway. My place is serving Cyprian, and I will stay where he is until the end.
What if I needed to send a letter to my sister in Hungary? One that I could send only with someone I trust absolutely?
Valentine smiled, with an expression too knowing and weary for a boy as young as he.
Then I would say I suspect you of tricking me. And anyway, I have heard your stories of your sister, and would rather take my chances here.
Radu laughed, shocked at how much the boy had picked up on.
Very well. But promise me one thing. If the city is falling around you, you do everything you can to get out. Do you understand? And if I am not here, you help Nazira and Cyprian get out.
Valentine stood even straighter, giving a dignified nod.
I will protect them with my life.
Good boy.
Valentine left, closing the door softly behind him. Cyprian moaned.
Radu rushed to the bedside. Cyprian, can you hear me?
Cyprian tried to lift a hand to his head, his eyes squeezed shut.
Radu.
Yes. You are safe, at home.
I think,
he croaked, his voice cracking.
I will get him something to drink,
Nazira hurried from the room.
Cyprian swallowed, still not opening his eyes. I think the city fell down on my head.
Radu laughed in relief.
It did. But you Byzantines are remarkably hard-headed.
Squinting, Cyprian looked at Radu.
Radu! You are here.
Yes, I am right here.
Cyprian lifted a hand, searching in the air.
Radu took it in his own.
I went back for you.
Cyprian's eyes drifted shut again. No, Radu said gently. I was not hurt. I brought you home. Remember? Cyprian shook his head, then cringed, crying out in pain. He squinted again.
No. I went back to Adirna for you.
What if the blow had permanently damaged Cyprian's mind?
We are not in Adirna. We are in Constantinople.
I know that, Cyprian snapped, rolling his eyes. You are very confused.
Radu tried not to smile.
You are right. I am the confused one.
We never spoke. But your face, the look you shared with him about the book, I never stopped thinking of you.
What book?
Radu wanted to keep Cyprian awake and talking, even if it was nonsense. Cyprian waved his free hand.
The book we gave the Sultan. You understood how funny it was. The dragon book. I wish so much I could laugh with you. Even then I knew you would have a wonderful laugh. He did not want me to go back, you know.
Radu searched his memory, trying to figure out what Cyprian was talking about. Books and dragons. And then it rushed back. Last year, the delegation from Constantinople after Mehmed's coronation. It was the first time Radu had seen Cyprian. Back when Cyprian was a nameless ambassador delivering a book on Saint George and the Dragon as a gift. Radu remembered that moment perfectly, too. That startling jolt when he had met Cyprian's clear grey eyes and seen the hidden laughter there.
Who did not want you to go back to Adirna? Radu asked, suddenly very interested in the conversation.
My uncle. Too dangerous. I insisted, though. I wanted to speak to you.
Radu's heart was racing.
To ask me to come here and give information on Mehmed?
No.
Cyprian's voice went far away and quiet.
I just wanted to speak to you. I wanted to hear you laugh.
He smiled, lifting their clasped hands toward Radu's cheek. Radu leaned his head down, letting Cyprian's fingers brush against his skin. Though his fingers were cold, the touch felt like fire.
I regret nothing,
Cyprian murmured, and then his face relaxed into sleep. The door clicked shut and Radu startled, looking up guiltily.
Oh, husband,
Nazira sighed, already in the room, for how long Radu did not know.
You almost make me believe in fate, for how unfortunate yours is.
She set down a bowl of broth and a mug of watered-down wine. Adjusting Cyprian's blankets, she knelt across the bed from Radu and looked up at him.
First a man with no heart to give you, and now a man who can never know your truths.
Radu stood, his pulse still racing, his cheeks flushed.
I am not...
Nazira looked tenderly at Cyprian, brushing some hair from his forehead.
I suspected, but I hoped I was wrong. It seemed too cruel, too absurd an irony.
You know I am loyal to Mehmed.
Nazira's face darkened faster than the tempest in the streets.
You owe him nothing more than your loyalty. Certainly not your love. Normally I would rejoice that your heart had stirred in another direction. But this...
She lowered her head onto the bed, hiding her face from him.
Oh, Radu, what will we do?
A bell in the distance tolled. Doom, doom, doom. Radu could not sit at Cyprian's bedside. He wandered the streets until nightfall. The storm had disappeared as suddenly as it came, the clouds taking residence on the earth instead. The air was still and dead,
the city shrouded as if for burial. As night fell, the fog thickened, masking all lights and making the city as dark as a cave. Radu had started toward home when muted cries of, "Fire! Fire!" broke through the fog. He turned, running in their direction, wondering if this was it, if the wall had finally fallen. Instead, he saw the roof of the Hagia Sophia flickering with light. Horrified, he ran several steps toward the church before stopping. It was not fire. The light danced and moved along the roof, but it was the wrong hue for fire, more white and blue than yellow. And there was no smoke. Radu watched, transfixed, as the light gathered around the main spire and then shot upward into the sky. He stared, blinking in the darkness, the afterimage playing across his vision. He had never seen anything like this, never heard of anything like it. But no, had not God appeared to Moses as fire? A cloud during the day, like the impenetrable fog, and a pillar of fire at night. Radu could not breathe, could not comprehend what he had seen, because the only way he could explain it was that he had seen the Spirit of God himself, and God had left Constantinople behind. But the fire had gone into the sky, not to the camps of the Ottomans. Perhaps all their prayers had cancelled each other out. It was only men against men now. God was right to abandon them. If anyone had decided on mercy and reason over stubbornness, all these lives could have been spared. If Mahmed had allowed the city to continue its natural, slow death rather than needing to claim it. If Constantine had bowed to the impossible odds and opted to save his people over his pride. Radu was so angry with both of them. Different possibilities spun through his mind. Killing Constantine, as he had considered. It would lead to surrender. Using Mahmed's trust and sending a message into the Ottoman camps that Hunyadi was on his way with an army from the Pope, that would tip things out of Mahmed's favor, forcing him to accept a new peace treaty. Either was a bigger betrayal than Radu had it in him to commit. And for that, he was as culpable as emperor or sultan. He could not make the hard decision, could not solve this where they refused to. Radu wandered, lost in the fog. It clung to him, questioning, nagging. Radu was sorrier than he had ever believed possible. Somewhere in the past months, he had grown to love this odd, superstitious, worn-down city. Somewhere in the past months he had grown to love the man who brought them here. But an end was coming. If Mahmed did not take the city, it would be his end. Halil would see to that. More Muslims would die in Christian crusades like Fatima's family had, and the city would still fall eventually. But if Radu helped the city fall now, he could save Mahmed. Radu could be at his side to see the future Mahmed would create. Lada had despised Radu for the fact that he would always choose Mahmed. Nazira had told him that he did not owe Mahmed his love. But he did owe Mahmed his life. And Mahmed was the only man who could fill the destiny laid out by the Prophet, peace be upon him. He had imagined Constantinople, had wanted it for Mahmed. It had been simple and straightforward. But now he knew the true cost of things. The murky horrors of the distance between wanting something and getting it. He had wanted Mahmed in ways he could never have him, and that, too, had slowly been destroying him. What, then, did he have left? Radu closed his eyes, remembering the light. God might have left the city, but Radu would never leave his God. And Constantinople, as it was, would always be a threat to Islam, bringing crusades, destabilizing the Ottoman Empire. Some lives are worth more than others, Lada had told him. He had wondered when the scales would tip out of their favor, had thought her a monster for valuing their lives above all others. But he had valued Mahmed above all. He valued Nazira more than any innocence in this city, and the value he had to admit he held for Cyprian would break his own heart. It was wrong, this weighing and measuring lives as though they were coins that could be spent or saved.
he longed to be free of it all.